war criminal. But on the other hand, the U.S. occupation was convinced that there was a unified conspiracy within the Japanese military. So they didn't know what to make of Ishiwara, who was always fighting with other officers and had publicly denounced Tojo. So in the end, they just ignored him. Although he was called as a witness for the defense at the Tokyo War Crimes Tribunal. And irrepressible as ever, Ishiwara took the witness stand and then denounced President Truman as a war criminal for the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But for all his bravado, Ishiwara's vision had come true only in the worst possible way. He was right about a new stage of war. He was right about aircraft unleashing unprecedented destruction on civilian populations. But those new weapons had not been used for Japan ushering in a glorious empire. They'd been used to defeat Japan. So when Ishiwara died in 1949 at age 60, he was probably as broken in spirit as Nitobe had been 16 years earlier. Now, it was Shidehara who arguably got the last laugh. He survived World War II, and his views were vindicated. He was even tapped by the U.S. occupation to serve as interim prime minister in 1945. And one of Shidehara's last public acts would shape Japan to this day. As you may know, the post-war Japanese constitution has an anti-war clause. Article 9 prohibits Japan from using war to settle international disputes. It's basically the Kellogg-Briand Pact written into the Japanese constitution. Now, some accounts say that General Douglas MacArthur, commander of the U.S. occupation, that he proposed this article to Shidehara, and some say that Shidehara proposed it to MacArthur. But either way, Shidehara sold it to his cabinet, and he was instrumental in getting it approved. In fact, some say Shidehara said Article 9 was an American demand, so his Japanese colleagues would accept it. They might argue with him, but not with the U.S. occupation. But whatever the details, Article 9 was written into law, and Japan would be an economic superpower, not a military superpower. And that was Shidehara's pre-war vision. Now, I doubt Shidehara in the 1920s expected that it would take defeat by the U.S. in a major war for his vision of Japan to prevail. In fact, he was horrified by the cost of the war. But when Shidehara died in 1951, just short of his 80th birthday, he found that looking backwards on his own life made him optimistic about Japan's future. Because what he foresaw for Japan in the coming decades, a peaceful Japan dedicated to economic power rather than military power, that was what he had tried to create 30 years earlier.
You are listening to Understanding Japan, a Cultural History, produced by The Great Courses in partnership with the Smithsonian Institution. Lecture 19. War Without a Master Plan. Japan, 1931 to 1945.
In 1946, a Tokyo University political science professor named Maruyama Masao looked back on the past 15 years of Japanese history. And he tried to explain what had happened, what had gone wrong. How had the Japanese leadership led the country into World War II, a war that had proved to be disastrous, and why did no one in the Japanese leadership feel personally responsible for the war? Well, Maruyama concluded that Japan had created something as dangerous as German fascism, but different. It had created despotism without a dictator, a country run by a cult of ultranationalism, but without a single leader, a country run by slogans instead of reason. In Japan, he observed, generals and cabinet ministers had all described themselves as loyal servants of the emperor, but they were also the emperor's advisors, and the emperor routinely ratified the consensus of his advisors, and the result was that everyone was responsible, but no one was responsible. Maruyama called this the psychology of ultranationalism, and it raised the dangers of groupthink to apocalyptic levels. It produced a leadership system in which few people had a sense of individual responsibility. For example, in late 1941, on the eve of Pearl Harbor, no one had the courage to openly say, attacking the U.S. is stupid. This is just compounding previous mistakes. Attacking the U.S. will not end the China war, but will instead draw us into a broader war. We need to cut our losses and get out of China now. Because saying something like that, that would require taking individual responsibility for earlier bad decisions. Or it would have involved criticizing the group. Or even worse, it could have been seen as disloyalty to the emperor and insufficient patriotic zeal. So while in the German case we can point to a single dictator, Hitler, who led his country into war, Japan had, as Maruyama put it, slithered into war, based on one bad decision after another, with no single leader ever feeling responsible for the disaster. Now, there are some problems with Maruyama's approach, but today I want to focus on what I think is his most valuable point, that Japan started a war in China and then a war with the U.S. and its allies based not on a master plan, but on pathological groupthink, a political culture in which the most fanatic and irrational voices repeatedly dominated common sense. So we'll look at two major examples. In 1937, when Japan embarked on a full-scale war in China, there were warnings then that this would lead to a quagmire, but those warnings were ignored. And in 1941, when Japan decided to attack the U.S., there were warnings that the U.S. would shift from demanding Japan's withdrawal from China to the goal of a complete defeat of Japan. And those voices were again ignored. Reason was discarded in favor of ultranationalist passion. Now, as we saw in another lecture, one key turning point in the lead-up to World War II was the takeover of Manchuria by the Japanese Kwantung Army in 1931. That was a turning point for three reasons. First, it marked a clear break with the U.S. The U.S. refused to recognize Japanese control of Manchuria, or the puppet government of Manchukuo that Japan established in 1932. Second, this marked a precipitous decline in the ability of Japan's civilian government to restrain the military. The government in Tokyo had not authorized the takeover of Manchuria. It was orchestrated entirely by a network of radical officers who were unhappy with Tokyo's policies. And amidst a wave of assassinations and attempted assassinations, the Tokyo government didn't even try to roll back what the military had done. But third, and most important for today's discussion, the takeover of Manchuria fostered a culture of insubordination within the Japanese military. The Kwantung Army had acted independently of the Army High Command, and instead of being punished, they acquired their own puppet state in China. And the Army's tolerance for that sort of freelance imperialism quickly came back to haunt them. In fact, within just a few years, one of the leaders of the Manchurian takeover, Ishiwara Kanji, was complaining that officers in the Kwantung Army were ignoring their superiors and carving out puppet states across North China, in Hebei, in Chahar, in Mongolia, and then presenting Tokyo with a fait accompli. Now, of course, that is exactly what Ishiwara himself had done. And the irony would be comic if the consequences weren't so dire. Now by 1937, Japan had seized much of North China. But at the highest levels, there was still hope for some sort of cooperation with Chiang Kai-shek, the leader of the Chinese nationalist government. The idea was to exploit Zhang's fear of Mao Zedong and the Chinese Communist Party. Japan could take as much of North China as it wanted, and Zhang would be content with what was left. He wouldn't fight back because at heart he hated Mao even more than he hated Japan. But that plan collapsed when Japan initiated a full-scale war in China. Now, we'll refer to this conflict as the Sino-Japanese War, although at the time in Japan it was referred to euphemistically as the China Incident. And that euphemism is informative because it wasn't supposed to be a total war. Yet. The Japanese army was getting ready for war, but up until 1936, it was too internally divided to have a comprehensive plan to conquer all of China. But then one army faction attempted a coup in February 1936, and when that coup failed, the leaders of the losing faction were purged, and that allowed the winning faction to finally begin planning for total war. And they had the Japanese bureaucracy look at what Japan would need in terms of natural resources and industrial capacity, what they would need in order to fight a full-scale war in China. And so, in 1936, the Japanese bureaucracy began developing a 5-year plan for national mobilization. It was influenced both by Nazi and by Soviet economic planning. The goal was to get Japan ready for protracted war. And there was a clear awareness in these plans that Japanese industrial capacity was inadequate. That's why there was a 5-year plan for the expansion of iron and steel production, for the expansion of coal production, for the expansion of shipbuilding. Japan was not ready in any of those areas. So according to the government's own plans, it should not have launched a full-scale war in China in 1937. In 1942, maybe. 1942 would have been the end year of the first 5-year plan, but not 1937. So what happened? Well, a skirmish erupted between Japanese and Chinese forces near Beijing in July 1937. And this time, Chiang Kai-shek was less concerned with fighting the communists and more concerned with fighting Japan. He began moving more troops to the area, and the government in Tokyo became furious at Zhang's newfound determination. They seemed to have been insulted that the leader of China had suddenly gotten serious about defending China. And a furious debate erupted within the Japanese cabinet about what to do. Now, according to the government's own planning documents, the right answer at this moment was to de-escalate the conflict, to implement the 5-year plan, and then to wait until around 1942 and crush Zhang like a bug. Even radical nationalists like Ishiwara, who had orchestrated the takeover of Manchuria, he insisted that Japan needed to build up its industrial base before starting a large-scale war in China. And the government was so divided over the question of whether or not to escalate the war that the orders to mobilize for a major offensive were issued and then rescinded 4 times. But in the end, the Japanese government made the wrong decision. They acted on the unfounded assumption that a decisive, crushing blow against Chiang Kai-shek would bring him to his knees. That was a catastrophic mistake, and that became apparent within less than a year. True, Japanese troops won a series of victories, Beijing, then Shanghai, then Nanjing. But Zhang did not surrender, even after the fall of Nanjing, which was his capital. And this led to an obvious conclusion. Japan was no longer fighting a conventional war in China. it was now fighting a guerrilla war in China, practically speaking, the largest country in the world. And it had started this war without a plan. So it did not have the capacity to feed or supply an army big enough to fight a non-conventional war in China. The Japanese leadership had led the nation into a quagmire. In fact, that lack of preparation helps explain the brutality with which Japanese troops treated the Chinese population. The rape of Nanjing is the most horrible example. That's where Japanese troops killed tens of thousands of non-combatants. From the outset of the Sino-Japanese War, Japan lacked the logistical capacity to feed its own men in China. So from the start of the war, the army lived off plunder. The army commanders basically acknowledged this. In August 1937, for example, the army issued a directive declaring that it was inappropriate to hold troops strictly to the laws of war, and that tacitly sanctioned the widespread abuse of the civilian population. And this was compounded by the lack of support for holding POWs. Japan had nowhere near enough MPs to guard POW camps, and they wouldn't have had enough food for the POWs even if they had had enough MPs. In any case, the war with China dragged on, as year after year, Japan lost more and more men with no victory in sight. The magnitude of this disaster was utterly clear by 1940. It was so clear that a brave member of the Japanese Diet, named Saito Takao, gave a 90-minute speech in which he dismantled the government's conduct of the war, and he demanded that the government explain its own propaganda. The government's official policy was that Japan would respect the independence of China, Japan would not seek territorial concessions in China, Japan would not seek an economic monopoly in China, Japan would respect third-party rights in China, and would withdraw its troops from China once the war was over. But at the same time, the Japanese leadership was referring to the conflict as a holy war, a seisen, for establishing a new order in Asia. And Saito said, "Explain this to me. We have spent billions of yen fighting in China. We've lost 100,000 men. My district is losing sons in battle every day. And yet, as soon as we win in China, and by the way, you've never explained what you would define as a victory, but as soon as we win, we will completely withdraw from China without any expansion of territory or economic advantage." "Explain to me," he insisted, "how does that possibly compensate for the sacrifices you have already demanded of the Japanese people? And also, given that we are now 2 years into a war that you said you were going to win with a knockout blow 2 years ago, what is your plan for victory? Oh, and also, if the goal of the war was establishing a new order in Asia, then why did it take a committee a year and a half after the war started to come up with that slogan? And what does the slogan mean? In short," he said, "can anyone here tell me why we are at war?" Now, Saito's speech was censored, and he was voted out of the Diet, although he was re-elected in 1942, and he even lived to tell his story after World War II. But the key point here is that the Sino-Japanese War was obviously a quagmire by 1940, and those voices with the courage to say so were stifled or ignored. Well, the worst was yet to come, because in order to resolve the China quagmire, the government recklessly expanded the war to include the U.S. and its allies. Tensions between Japan and the U.S. came to a head in July 1941. Japan seized South Indochina, and in response, the U.S. and its allies declared an oil embargo on Japan. Until then, the U.S. was actually one of Japan's major oil suppliers. And that embargo not only cut off that oil, but the U.S. and Great Britain also simultaneously froze Japanese assets. Now, in Japan, this was interpreted as a demand that Japan surrender its empire. Take, for example, the words of Hara Yoshimichi, chair of the Imperial Privy Council. Hara was deeply concerned by the specter of a broader war, but he felt Japan had no other option. If Japan gave in, he argued, it would give up all its gains in the Sino-Japanese War and the Russo-Japanese War, and also the gains from the Manchurian incident, and Hara found that unacceptable. Now, he granted that the Japanese people had endured great hardship since the start of the war in 1937, and he was loath to compel them to suffer even more. But he went on to say that the very existence of Japan was being threatened, and that all the great achievements of the Meiji Emperor would come to nothing. So he concluded that Japan had no choice. It had to go to war with the U.S. And there's just one problem with this statement. None of the critical points are true. None of the U.S. demands in 1941 mentioned Korea or Taiwan. Those were the colonies that Japan had gained in the Sino-Japanese and Russo-Japanese wars. In fact, Teddy Roosevelt had supported Japanese claims on Korea. So the links to the Meiji Emperor were baseless. Nor was Manchuria really an issue. The U.S. had refused to recognize the puppet state of Manchukuo since its founding in 1932. But they had done nothing about it. And as for Japanese gains in China since 1937, they were already clearly unsustainable. The Japanese army and the Japanese nation were being bled dry. So the U.S. demand that Japan give up its gains in China was merely a demand that Japan recognize the futility of trying to rule all of China. And nothing in the 1941 exchanges between the U.S. and Japan threatened, as Hara put it, the existence of Japan. On the contrary, it was the opposite. If Japan attacked the U.S., that would provoke a war in which the U.S. might demand control over the Japanese home islands. So Hara's reasoning suffered from the defect of starting from flawed assumptions, ignoring the alternatives, and racing to the wrong conclusion. And what's striking here is that Hara wasn't a militarist. He had served as justice minister and as a university president, but he was not a military man or even a staunch advocate of war. In fact, he was leery of a broader confrontation with the U.S., but at a critical moment, even he began speaking in propaganda talking points instead of careful analysis. And because of this inflated sense of what would happen if Japan began withdrawing from China in 1941, because the costs of that decision were inflated, they seemed larger than the cost of attacking the U.S. Even though on the eve of Pearl Harbor, military planners knew that if the war with the U.S. went on for more than 2 years, Japan would lose. Japan would lose because it was dependent on imported food and imported raw materials. So the Navy and the Merchant Marine needed a fleet big enough to fight the U.S. and the U.K. while also defending thousands of miles of sea lane. And both were critical. If there weren't enough combat fleet, the Merchant Marine would not be able to safely supply Japan with food and raw materials. And every combat ship that was lost would have to be replaced with largely imported raw materials. The Navy started the war with almost no slack in that system. So with that in mind, let me give you a new perspective on the December 1941 attack on Pearl Harbor. It's probably one of the best-known events in military history. The U.S. lost 8 battleships, hundreds of aircraft, thousands of men. Japanese losses were minimal. And this was a huge defeat for Japan. Because for Pearl Harbor to be successful, the U.S. would have had to abandon the Pacific theater in order to focus on Europe. As soon as it became clear that the U.S. was going to keep fighting in the Pacific, the clock started running. And the U.S. had 30 times the iron and steel capacity of Japan. So in terms of replacing sunken ships, that clock was not in Japan's favor. And this means that 6 months after Pearl Harbor, at the Battle of Midway, in June 1942, Japan effectively lost the war. The Japanese Navy assumed that the U.S. Navy was broken and demoralized. They didn't realize that 6 of those 8 battleships sunk at Pearl Harbor were being repaired. And they didn't know that U.S. intelligence had broken their code. And at Midway, the Japanese Navy lost 4 aircraft carriers and the U.S. 1. And the simple fact was, if the U.S. was able to fight that well 6 months after Pearl Harbor, it was no longer reasonable to assume that the war would end soon. But the same flawed decision-making that had led Japan to war made it impossible for the Japanese government to accept that fact for another 3 years. At the cost of millions of lives in China, at least 1 million lives in Japan, and over 100,000 Allied casualties. And over those 3 years, not only Japanese troops, but the Japanese people were being steadily bled dry, running out of fuel, running out of food, and running out of hope. So by the summer of 1944, a motley group of Japanese officials, industrialists, generals, businessmen, court nobles, men who actually had little in common and normally disagreed about almost everything, they agreed that if Japan did not end the war soon, it would collapse into anarchy or revolution. The Japanese people were starving, they were exhausted, and they were distrustful. And if the war did not end soon, the Japanese people would fall prey to communist agitation, and the emperor system would be lost, not to an invading army, but to a domestic communist revolution. And so they prepared a memo to present to the emperor. Now, unfortunately, this group was discovered by Japanese intelligence, and they were punished, even though their basic contention was sound. Japanese business needed to begin thinking about surrender to the U.S. So once again, fear of heresy trumped reason, and the war went on. So why did Japan finally surrender? That question is still debated. 3 things happened in quick succession. The bombing of Hiroshima on August 6th, the Soviet Union abrogating their neutrality pact with Japan and attacking on August 8th, and the bombing of Nagasaki on August 9th. Historians are still trying to understand how these combined to force Japanese surrender. But one thing is certain. The prospect of fighting the USSR made surrender to the U.S. suddenly look like an appealing option. So what are the lasting consequences of slithering towards war, as Maruyama Masao put it? Well, let me begin with a troubling result. The diffuse responsibility for starting the war made it difficult to allocate responsibility post-war. In 1946, the Allies set up a war crimes tribunal, known as the International Military Tribunal for the Far East, or the Tokyo War Crimes Tribunal. This was essentially a counterpart to the Nuremberg trials, and the prosecutors started looking for a Japanese counterpart to Hitler, or at least a Japanese counterpart to the Nazi Party. They were looking for evil by master plan instead of evil from collective irresponsibility. And with that focus on a master plan, the prosecutors defined the very worst war crimes, what they called Class A war crimes, as participation in that master plan. And they downgraded to Class B or even Class C many war crimes in the conventional sense, like the execution or even the torture of POWs. And the result is that the Tokyo War Crimes Tribunal never got at the substance of Japanese war crimes. The prosecution couldn't make the case for a massive conspiracy because there was no master plan. And yet they minimized thousands of clear-cut cases of atrocities against POWs and civilians. They made those crimes sound less awful than they were through their own terminology. They downgraded them to Class B or Class C. A second, less troubling consequence is that much of the Japanese elite was eager to cooperate with the U.S. in the post-war period. Some were probably thinking, thank you for saving us from our own decisions. Others were probably thinking, thank you for saving us from the Soviet Union. But virtually no one thought that Japan should fight on. So U.S. soldiers, who had expected to be fighting in the streets of Japan, were instead greeted by Japanese officers who asked, how can I be of help? But perhaps the most striking consequence is a deep-rooted Japanese pacifism. More than two generations after the end of the war, most Japanese still associate troops overseas with disaster. And you can see this in 21st century politics. As you know, Article 9 of Japan's post-war constitution renounces war and the maintenance of armed forces. And much of Japan's political elite wants to change that. They consider it an infringement on Japanese sovereignty. But constitutional revision remains extremely unpopular in the general public. The public is more than 2-1 against changing Article 9. And what's striking is that this opposition to constitutional change, it coexists with heightened fears of Chinese military power. And if you ask voters, how do you reconcile wanting somehow a stronger military with your support of Article 9, they'll often just say, we should not send troops overseas. Japan just should not do that. And I think that vague but deep-seated suspicion of foreign intervention, that Japanese troops overseas cannot possibly end well, that's a lasting consequence of Japan's experience in World War II. And that's actually a positive outcome of Japan launching a war without a clear plan or reason. Two generations later, also without a clearly articulated reason, the Japanese people remain tenaciously averse to war.
Lecture 20, Japanese Family Life.
Today, we're going to engage an aspect of Japan that's both hugely important and, for a historian, extremely difficult. The family. Now, the reasons why it's hugely important may be obvious. How parents raise their children is one of the main ways in which culture and tradition are conveyed from generation to generation. When we generalize and say that the Japanese act this way, or Australians do it this way, or the French do that, we're talking about habits and attitudes that are first learned in the home. How to eat, how to address strangers, when to smile. This is stuff you learn at home from a very young age. And what makes for a good marriage partner? What do you look for? These are the things that we begin to learn before we are even aware of it, by watching our parents. So families are one of the main ways that societies transmit values and traditions. But what's frustrating for the historian is that we know about the past primarily through written records. And for most of human history, the written record neglects mundane aspects of daily life. For example, there is no 1457 Japanese version of Dr. Spock's Baby and Child Care. There is no 1607 Japanese edition of What to Expect When You're Expecting. And there's absolutely, positively no 1715 edition of How to Know If It's Time to Go. Those sorts of dense and explicit discussions of what a good family should look like, those are a modern phenomenon. So historians, we find ourselves using lots of indirect sources. We can get at least some idea of family life from indirect testimony about family values, from literature, of course, and from documents like wills and legal proceedings. When we look at divorce records, for example, we can get some idea of how husbands and wives were expected to treat each other. That is, we can look at failed marriages to infer what was considered proper. So, bearing in mind the challenges of using indirect sources, let's try a sweep through about 10 centuries of Japanese history, starting with the court society of the Heian era and ending with the Japanese family today. And to organize our discussion, let's identify three main models of the Japanese family. First, there's the aristocratic model, or the uji. Second, there's the samurai model, or the ie. And finally, there's the modern model of Japanese family life. Now, historically, those three models overlap to some degree. But we can think of the uji model as dominant until the 1200s or so, and the ie model as dominant from the 1300s until the 1900s, and the modern family as largely a post-war phenomenon. So, how are these family systems different? Well, both the uji and the ie models featured lots of kids and lots of intergenerational connections, whereas the modern Japanese family is largely a nuclear family, two parents and one or two children. So one important difference is scale. But the other is structure. Uji were sprawling family units with lots of branches and complex kinship ties. Uji basically means clan. Ie, by contrast, means household. And the ie family model was more linear, with a clear patriarch and a clear single-stranded line of succession. So let's start with the uji model. This is a model that was quite suitable for a marriage politics approach to power. You have lots of daughters and lots of sons, and you marry them all over the place. Then you have lots of in-laws and nieces and nephews and grandchildren all over the place. And then you can use blood ties to build a dense web of political alliances. This sort of marriage politics was a central feature of Heian period Japan. And you may recall that the master of marriage politics was Fujiwara no Michinaga, who lived from 966 to 1028. Now, to allow for these fluid webs of power, Heian marriage had multiple patterns. In fact, it's difficult to describe exactly how marriages worked in Heian aristocratic families because there are so many variations. A husband and wife could live separately. They could live together with the wife's parents. They could live together with the husband's parents or form their own household. Even after marriage, however, noble women kept control of their own property. In fact, they could dispose of it without their husband's approval. Heian-era women wrote their own wills. Now, it's sometimes tempting to make a strict contrast between matriarchy and patriarchy, and Heian society offers us a good reason not to do that. Because in the Heian court, keeping women independent in their marriage often served their father's interests. Remember, at the apex of power, the game was to marry your daughter to the emperor so that the next emperor could be your grandson. So keeping women independent in marriage was partly about securing power for their fathers. In any case, the uji model, with its webs of interaction, was strikingly different from the ie model of later samurai society. That model was for a society built on war. And I like to think of the ES system as a military command model of the family. Dense webs of influence are fine in court politics, but not so good in battle, where you want a clear and unitary command structure. And this helps us understand why the ES system did not favor partible inheritance. If you controlled a 20,000-man army, well, you'd want to pass that military power down as a whole, wouldn't you? Breaking a 20,000-man army into two 10,000-man armies is bad, and breaking it down into five 4,000-man armies is even worse. Big armies tend to trounce smaller armies. And unless, I guess, your two daughters and your three sons can act as one, then splitting a samurai inheritance five ways is a bad idea. In fact, if the inheritance is a military command, should those two daughters get anything at all? Now, this contrast between the aristocratic families of the Heian court and the samurai families of later centuries, this contrast is useful so long as we realize that the early samurai still thought a lot like courtiers. The shift from the Uji system to the Ie system was a gradual transition. In fact, in the 1200s and the 1300s, the legal codes of the first shogunate in Kamakura showed a strong courtier influence. Women still had the powers of Heian society. For example, according to Kamakura law, if a man gave property to his wife and he then divorced her, he could only reclaim the land if he could prove that she was guilty of some serious transgression. And early samurai law seems to have enabled women to perpetuate their own family lines independent of their husbands. Childless women or women without sons could adopt a male heir to convey property. Moreover, when women inherited their husbands' land rights, the shogunate allowed them to manage the land just like any male vassal would. Yes, women hired proxies to do certain vassal duties, like military service, but they could manage the estates on their own. Now, this period of fluidity produced one of the most powerful women in Japanese history, Hojo Masako. Masako was the wife of the first Kamakura shogun, Minamoto no Yoritomo, and she was arguably the single most powerful person in the early 1200s. In fact, the Hojo family displaced the Minamoto. Hojo men ruled as regents to child shoguns, and for all practical purposes, the Minamoto line died out as a ruling house. In fact, the disappearance of the Minamoto is one reason I refer to the regime founded by Minamoto no Yoritomo as the Kamakura shogunate rather than the Minamoto shogunate. The regime started as the Minamoto shogunate, but it effectively became the Hojo shogunate. The one constant was the capital city, Kamakura. So what did Hojo Masako do? Well, she effectively ran the Kamakura shogunate after her husband's death in 1199. She did not remarry. That might have raised questions about her loyalty and chastity. Instead, she became a Buddhist nun. But that was simply a cover to allow her to wield power indirectly. She's sometimes referred to as the nun shogun, the Ama shogun. Now, as a power behind the throne, Masako removed male figureheads who opposed her, including her own son and her own father. She was also instrumental in rallying Minamoto vassals to crush an uprising against the shogunate in 1221. Now, what's noteworthy about Hojo Masako's life is that she commonly ruled in concert with a male relative, her son or her father or her brother. and she was discreet about her power. But there's no question that she was decisive in sustaining the Hojo and their control over the shogunate. And we can think of Hojo Masako as emblematic of women in the early stages of warrior rule, when women could still control their own property and manage their own affairs. However, this began to break down in the late 13th century. As samurai culture developed, so did the Iye system I described a moment ago. The decisive factor was probably the Mongol invasions of 1274 and 1281. Resisting the Mongols required real combat, and having women send proxies really didn't fit that need. But in any case, by the late 1300s, women had largely lost the right to inherit or amass property. And families began to have a single clear male patriarch who had commanding authority over his wife and children. Again, it helps to think of this as a military model of the family, in which a samurai's relationship to his lord became a model for how a patriarch should be treated within his own household. So a woman initiating a divorce from her husband is like a samurai initiating a divorce from his lord, and that's called desertion. A woman disobeying her husband is like a samurai disobeying his lord, which is insubordination. And a woman having an extramarital affair, that's like a samurai serving another lord altogether, which is sedition. To put it another way, in the Iye system, when a woman marries, she enters her husband's household. She effectively severs ties with her birth family and becomes a member of her husband's family. Or, to put it in military terms, there are no dual loyalties. Interestingly, under the Iye system, the power of the household head, the patriarch, was not limited to power over women and children. Household heads also had authority over their siblings. You see, a patriarch was commonly succeeded by a single patriarch, usually his eldest son, and that meant that everyone in the household was under that eldest son, not just the son's wife, but also his brothers and sisters, the sisters at least until they married and entered someone else's house. And because the Iye system did not favor partible inheritance, younger sons often needed their elder brother's permission to marry, because a younger brother's wife would be entering the elder brother's household, and any children of that marriage would be members of the elder brother's household. This structure gave rise to the Japanese saying, "The sibling is the beginning of the stranger," or "Kyōdai wa tanin no hajimari." Because within the Iye system, younger siblings, especially brothers, had great reason to resent their father's chosen heir. Now, we've been talking so far about elite families, the Heian aristocracy, and the samurai families of later centuries. And that's because until the 1600s, our knowledge of commoner families is extremely limited. But beginning in the 1600s, with the economic boom of the Tokugawa peace, and with the spread of basic literacy, we start to get a better understanding of how commoners lived. And when we look at the historical record, there's a striking contrast between samurai and commoner approaches to family life. Now, early modern laws reflected samurai attitudes. So legal documents tended to squeeze commoner families into a samurai mold. But farm families simply didn't think about women in the same way. For farm families, some level of compatibility between husband and wife was important, especially if it was a less wealthy family and the couple really needed to work together to make ends meet. So attitudes towards both marriage and divorce were different. For a samurai woman, leaving your husband and returning to your parents' house was parallel to a soldier deserting his post. But commoners weren't soldiers, so that analogy didn't hold. Instead, we find that farm families also placed a greater emphasis on marital happiness, or at least compatibility. Here's an account that's both amusing and informative. The story involves a traveler in the Shinano region. The traveler was staying overnight with a farm family, and after dinner, the newlyweds in the family excused themselves, and in the large main room, separated only by a screen, they began to have sex. Now the guest remarked that this was not quite right, and his host threatened to throw him out. She explained that harmony between husband and wife is the cornerstone of prosperity, so nothing could be more auspicious than newlywed passion. In cases of divorce, farm families were also more willing to take daughters back and help them remarry. Now, commoner women did not have the legal right to initiate divorce. So sometimes they would leave their husbands to visit their sick parents and then just not come back. And sometimes the legal documents show that the parents were never really sick, although they were willing to take their daughters back. In other cases, unhappy women used temples to get a divorce. Although the women themselves did not have legal standing, many temples would give them a divorce, because if a woman agreed to become a nun, then her husband was impeding her spiritual progress by opposing a divorce and opposing the temple by not granting her a divorce. Frequently, though, once women got a divorce, they just returned to the laity and returned to their parents. In fact, there were temples in Japan that were known as divorce temples. Now, this leads to something of a paradox in Tokugawa marriage, because wealthier farm families, families who were social climbers, they wanted to imitate samurai families. They might even send a daughter to a samurai household to work as a servant, so she could learn the ways of the upper class. So in wealthier, commoner families, women had less freedom in marriage than in poor families. They entered arranged marriages at an earlier age than girls from poor families, who were often allowed to choose their own marriage partners. So ironically, while wealthier women certainly had more opportunities for a rich cultural life, in terms of freedom in marriage, poorer women had more choice. Okay, we've examined family life from the Heian era through the Tokugawa shogunate. But what about modern times? Well, with the Meiji Restoration, the new government attempted to create a national standard of civil law. They didn't complete that project until the 1890s, but they wiped away all the idiosyncrasies of local laws and customs. And to a large degree, these reforms pushed samurai attitudes towards the family onto the rest of society. Meiji law sort of merged samurai and Victorian attitudes towards the family and effectively codified the idea that women have inferior rights to men. So ironically, women actually lost some rights in the late 19th century. In some Tokugawa-era villages, for example, property-holding households voted to elect their village headman. And while household heads were commonly men, widows with young children could serve as household heads. And in those circumstances, women voted. But then in the Meiji era, those women lost the right to vote. So to truly explore the modern model of family life, we need to look beyond the Meiji Restoration, because the striking change in family structure didn't come until the U.S. occupation after World War II. And the first thing we notice is a huge change, stemming largely from the post-war constitution. That constitution was heavily influenced by U.S. progressive politics. The constitution, for example, has an equal rights clause. Women are fully equal to men before the law. And family law must be based on, quote, individual dignity and the essential equality of the sexes. The Constitution also stipulates that marriage should be, quote, maintained through mutual cooperation with the equal rights of husband and wife as a basis. So in constitutional law, Japan is a paradise of gender equality. Except that some aspects of the Japanese civil code still reflect the old ES system. For example, in Japan, everyone is registered in a koseki, a household register. And since everyone in a household should have the same family name, the koseki system makes it difficult for women to keep their original family name after marriage. Now, while this is just technically an administrative matter, it tends to collide with the constitutional idea that everyone is equal and everyone is an individual before the law. The koseki system also complicates divorce. Japanese law really does not provide for joint custody of children. If the parents split, the child goes with one party or the other, with one ie or the other. You can't be in between. I encountered this personally when I tried to go to Japan on sabbatical with my wife's children by her first marriage. The foreign ministry quickly approved my visa and my wife's visa, but they could not figure out what to do with my stepchildren. We had a letter from their biological father saying that he fully approved of the trip. But their visa applications went from the foreign ministry to the justice ministry, where the paperwork sat while someone struggled to figure out what this could mean in terms of Japanese law. To whom did these kids belong? But perhaps the biggest challenge for families in modern Japan is the low birth rate and the low rate of family formation. In the 1920s, a Japanese woman had, on average, more than 5 children. It dropped to around 2 in the 1950s, and today it's around 1.4. Now, Japan's low birth rate is not remarkable for an economically developed country. It's about the same as Italy and Germany, and it's higher than South Korea. But many people don't make that connection. For example, I once had an Italian colleague tell me with a straight face that the low birth rate in Japan resulted from the terrible status of women, but in Italy, it was because women were having so much fun. Now, in reality, of course, it's both reasons in both Japan and Italy. In both countries, women are delaying marriage and limiting fertility because they can earn money independently and they can travel and enjoy themselves. But at the same time, in both countries, child rearing is extremely demanding, government support is limited, and neither Italian nor Japanese men are known for their great willingness to share chores like diaper changing. And when it comes to finding a man to marry, well, until the 1980s, a Japanese man with a white-collar job in a major corporation could count on steady employment for the rest of his life, and that made him an attractive marriage partner. But Japan's long recession has undermined that career path. And in Japan, as almost everywhere in the world, men with low incomes and unstable jobs are much less attractive as marriage partners. Now, for years, the Japanese government has been in a state of mild panic over low Japanese fertility. Because Japan has the highest life expectancy in the world, and therefore demographers see a tidal wave of gray in Japan's future, a huge population of elderly men and women, and a shrinking working age population, and therefore a shrinking tax base. And one obvious solution is to make it possible for women to both raise children and participate in the labor force.